Moving countries, but to yet another lovely accent. So with great pleasure I'd like to present Alessandra Graziotto from Italy, and she is the director of the Centre of Gynecology and Medical Sexology at San Raffaele Resinati in Milan, and she's also the consultant professor at the University of Florence and University of Parma, and she also, I know, is a visiting professor at the Department of Urology, in fact, William Beaumont Hospital in Michigan. So she has many, many hats, and has obviously done a lot of work with Lorraine in her capacity as an obstetrician gynecologist, but also in oncology and a psychotherapist in sexual medicine. So welcome.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm thrilled to be here, dear Lorraine, dear Mrs. Chairwoman, dear colleague, and ladies and gentlemen, to share with you my happiness and honor in being here and sharing with you, first of all, our love and affection for a splendid scientific trendsetter and a splendid and generous friend. So this is the main reason why I'm even moved, and I hope you will forgive me for being a bit driven by my emotional feelings. Now, I'll focus on this topic, that is sexual function and dysfunction across the menopause, with a couple perspective. For all of you, I like to quote my website, www.alessandragraziottin.it, where you can download, this is the information for the resident here, quite a number of papers written with Lorraine, by the way, and Ginny Alexander and Harry Berger, so that you have the written information on many things that are presented here. Now, I will focus on the relational factors as contributors of FSD with two perspectives. Her perspective, particularly focusing on determinants and predictors of FSD, and his perspective. Men have been a bit in the shadow today, so I'd like to take them out a bit. And a focus on the impact of male sexual dysfunction and ED treatment on her sexual function with what is my area of highest interest, that is the clinical approach at the end of the day. And I would say that Lorraine is the first sexual ecologist of the world because she managed with her fantastic vision to integrate in a comprehensive model a number of factors that are biological, psychological, and context related, and give us all an understanding, a deep understanding of the complexity of the transition across, I would say, the whole women's life, from puberty to the elderly age. Now, the question that I'll try to address and share with you, based on her work and other author here, is how are sexual desire, activity, and behavior related in men and women? So with a couple perspective. First of all, part one, her perspective. And the first, I'd like to quote the Women's International Survey on Health and Sexuality, the WISHES group. Lorraine is the leading investigator of the group, and I'm honored to be part of it, together with Jean Alexander and others. The first research I'd like to present, part of the data, is based on France, Germany, Italy, UK, 2,467 women investigated, two validated questionnaires, the profile of female sexual function and the personal distress scale, UK, Germany, France, and Italy. And here is the first set of data that addresses a very important point that is in line with David Schnark's reading of the complexity of desire. And the reading is that the partner with the lowest level of desire controls the relationship and controls the frequency to some extent. Indeed, you see here that with the lowest levels of desire, it's the probability that women will initiate intercourse is virtually nothing. She also will say no thank you once in three times when he proposes. Quite interesting, when her desire goes up, he is more thrilled and excited by her activity. But quite important, the probability to have the intercourse increases almost linearly with her desire. And even more important for us women, the probability that we reach orgasm goes up as well. Now, what about the enemies of desire and sexuality in the couple? Age is the first enemy, with a reduction with age of female initiation, partner initiation, obviously the result of it that is the frequency of intercourse and the frequency of orgasm. And what about the relationship between age and menopause? Again, Lorraine and my studies, you see that in women younger than 50, 19% of women surveyed in the four countries report low desire. This percentage goes up significantly up to 32% when they have undergone a surgical menopause. After the age of 50, almost one in two says, I have low desire. The clinical question is low desire per se a good reason to treat these women? No. According to the international definition and consensus, we consider that it is worth of treatment when it becomes a disorder. And to become a disorder, women should report that they are distressed because of the loss. And again, and currently with the clinical experience, the youngest are the most distressed in comparison to the oldest. To summarize the finding, you see that the probability of having low desire increases almost linearly with age. The probability of being distressed because of low desire decreases with age. And the probability of having hypoactive sexual desire disorder, that is worth of clinical help, increases slightly with age. Now, what about the complexity of the relationship between culture and nature? Again, analyzing the countries by each country, you see what we already know in Europe, but this is the solid evidence, that the French women are the happiest. Those who report the lower level of low desire, half of the reported frequency of UK women. But what is fascinating for us all, I hope, is to see that, yes, culture is in play when hormones work. But when women undergo a major negative event like a surgical menopause, all the cultural differences are blunted. Now, how do women endorse their feelings of having been deprived of something essential like desire? You see here a number of feelings, frustrated, concerned, unhappy, disappointed, ashamed, that can be clustered under depression, sadness, feeling less feminine, but most important from my perspective is that 63%, say the highest percentage, report that they were most concerned because they were letting their partner down. So their relational impact of their low desire was most distressing to them. Now, what about a further reading that Lorraine did on a bigger size, including the US data that were collected with the same instrument? And what she found and published is that the impact of the surgical menopause indeed is strong, with an odds ratio of 2.1 of having a hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And this impact of the surgical menopause is stronger in the youngest, as we have seen also in the European data, with a 16% versus 7% for those non-surgical menopause when considered younger than 50. And then the difference is still maintained after the average age of the menopause. You may ask why? Because the ovary still produces some testosterone after the age of 50. And this may explain why depriving women, even after 50, of their ovaries deprives them of something that kicks up or may help and contributes, biologically speaking, to their sexuality. Now, a very recent paper that Lorraine contributed to with myself, Pat Kochake, and Cinzia Rodenberg, and has been presented last month at the international meeting in Amsterdam. It is prevalence of hypoactive sexual desire disorder in surgical menopausal women in Western Europe. What we found is that women with low desire have really a significantly lower probability of initiating sexual intercourse This is also true with the partner-initiated activity, but very interesting, again, culture is in play here. Indeed, you see that whilst French women seem to maintain quite a high responsiveness to their partner's initiative, same in the UK, Italians and Germans say no thank you most of the times. So there are very important male factors modulating the story that are possibly culturally driven. What about the frequency of intercourse? Again, there is a significant difference in the number of events in the last month between women with a normal desire and a low desire. And same story, obviously, with orgasm. And Italians seem to be the ones that when they have no desire, there is no likelihood they will reach orgasm. What about satisfaction? I like this set of data because it clearly differentiates the need when we surveyed couples to differentiate physical satisfaction, sexual satisfaction, from relational emotional satisfaction. Indeed, in this set of data, you see that there is a significant difference in the sexual satisfaction between women with normal desire and those with low desire, while somehow the satisfaction with the relationship is less affected. So what is the clinical implication of this part of my presentation? That when a woman complains of low desire, we should evaluate her age, the menopausal status, her being bilaterally ovariectomized or not, her feelings about the loss of desire, how distressed she feels because of that, how depressed she is, another very important point, her partner's health and sexual problems, and how she feels about her FSD. Now, moving to inactivity now. Another interesting set of data coming from Laumann that graphically describes a major couple crisis. You see that inactivity in men remains relatively stable across the decades, and this is possibly consistent with the remaining stable of the testosterone from the 20s to the 60s. While in women, you remember Henry Berger presentation, the testosterone decreases from the 20s upwards, and by chance you see the inactivity increases. But what's interesting is that from the 50s to the 60s, the inactivity in women almost triples in comparison to men. Consider that 82% of these couples are married or common law, so there is really a major crisis here. What is the merit of Loren? Asking and investigating why we do have that. What are the contributors of this increasing gap between the 50s and the 60s? And indeed, the question is then, which factors affect sexual inactivity? Again, you know everything about your study. What I like to quote is what I did in the year 2000 when I was invited to speak at the British Menopause Society, where I quoted extensively her work. So everybody at the end asked me, but is she your best friend? Yes, she is, scientifically speaking, because at that time I haven't yet met her, but I loved her job and her research, so I quoted her work extensively. So, and what I quoted, and this is the old slide of mine, that she found after 6 years that they were significantly diminished with time, the feelings for partner, responsivity, frequency of sexual activity, and libido, and significantly increased with time, the vaginal dryness and dyspareunia, and partner problems. And what I found at that time, and still now very interesting, is that the effects of feelings for partner on libido were more significant than that of hormones. And same from the same paper, that possible determinants of sexual functioning, again feelings and partner problem, and you will see from other researcher data that this is absolutely the pure truth, and then that indicators are the ones that you already know. She further went ahead and found that change in sexual function with the menopausal transition are expressed and present in 42% in women in early menopausal transition, up to 88% in the post-menopause. Her studies graphically are represented here with the change in total sex score. You are already aware of that. Just to summarize what she did in this area, a decrease in partner feelings, responsivity, frequency, libido, and an increase in vaginal dryness and partner problems. You have already listened to this explanation of this model. What I like of this model as a gynecologist is the fact that this estradiol affects the, first of all, the neurovegetative pathways with two major tracks. One is the mental tract, and the other is the genital tract. So I further elaborated with the mental, with a gynecological perspective, the story. First of all, considering that mood in the shadow is a powerful modulator of desire in women, but not only women, as you will see. And the other is putting together her feelings, her data, with my experience in this model that addresses a bit of a different perspective. That is, whatever the stimulus that we perceive as sexual from the external stimuli or internal stimuli, they have for two tracks, as I mentioned, thanks to her research. One, mood and feelings for partner. But the other, that has as a major determinant, the lowering of vaginal estradiol and the vaginal dryness, is the genital feedback. We don't pay enough attention to the importance of genital feedbacks in women, and we gynecologists should really become more and more aware that this is a critical part of the story besides all that we already know about this part of the story. And indeed, the other point that was so inspiring to me from her research is that when the stimulus is perceived as sexual, it activates billions of neurotransmitters. These billions of neurotransmitters are modulated by sexual hormones, and by that very moment, they immediately activate three major pathways in the brain. The neurovegetative, that prepares the body for sex, and by this genital response affects with a feedback, positive or negative, the internal feelings, including mood and feelings for partner, the emotional affective pathway with the mood that modulates in positive or negative affects the overall experience, and then the cognitive side of the story where we evaluate the wish and risk to behave sexually. So what we perceive from the behavioral clinical point of view is just the tip of the iceberg of a very complex change within the brain and within the body that was so well clarified thanks to Lorraine's comprehensive vision of the changes. And indeed, what she found and published more and more defined is that the factors affecting sexual function and the sexual response, particularly at prior level of sexual response, of course, the experience, the personal history does matter, and this is absolutely true. Change in partner, yes. Feelings for partner, absolutely yes. And the estradiol level, and this is why, as a gynecologist, I'm enthusiastic about that. This story addresses the neurovegetative side of the response. As I said, on the brain, on the genital tract. And dyspareunia, again, prior level of dyspareunia, because the variable hidden here is the tonus of the elevator ani. So the hyperactive pelvic floor is a contributor and a maintenance factor of pain across the decades. So another area we gynecologists and GPs should pay attention to. But the other, again, critical is the estradiol level. And what about hormones and female sexuality then? To summarize so many things that we know now, yes, of course, they modulate sexual identity and sex, secondary sex character, so self-image, so to say. They work as conditioners on sexual desire, on arousal. They're very important permitting factors for the vasoactive intestinal peptide. They modulate the vasodilatation, vasocongestion, lubrication, but importantly, vasocongestion not only in the vagina, but around the urethra, and this is one of the critical factors why we do have such an important comorbidity, particularly with postcoital cystitis and recurrent cystitis after the menopause, because the vaginal dryness is not the only problem, but without estradiol, also the urethra is no more protected by the usual congestion of the equivalent of the corpus spongiosum that Ellen O'Connell has so well shown to be present in the lower third of urethra. And the other aspect why estrogens are so critical for the menopausal transition, with a couple of perspectives, is that they modulate together with testosterone the sexual signals, and particularly the pheromone secretion that gives women the scent of a woman. That's so important also for the partner. But also the quality of the lubrication eases penetration. So if she's dry and if she has a mild difficulty in erection, her dryness will precipitate his ED, erectile deficit. So this is another point why we should pay attention to both members of the couples. Now, again, thanks to Lorraine, we know that just by the third year after the menopause, vaginal dryness is a major issue for women's sexuality. Almost one in two complains of this symptom if we pay attention to her, from her to her wording and to the physical examination. And do we have a tool as gynecologists and GPs to objectively prove that this is the case? Yes, we do have the variation of the vaginal pH that you see very clearly overlaps with the clinical reporting of the vaginal dryness. So the recording of the vaginal pH is a tool in evaluating what's going on quickly in our office. And indeed, when I examine my patient, I always record the vaginal pH. This little thing that costs nothing, by the way, and requires 5 seconds just to be inserted in the vagina, turns from yellow, that is normal pH, 4, to green or even blue when she complains of vaginal dryness and she's without estrogen. So this is indicative of an important loss of hormones, as Lorraine has proven, that we clinically find absolutely coherent with the symptoms, and indeed symptoms of vaginal dryness, vulnerability to recurrent vaginitis, particularly from Escherichia coli and Enterococcus faecalis, and dyspareunia. And you see that if we examine, yes, there is atrophy here, but particularly this reddening is suggestive of microtrauma to the introitus that will lead to chronic inflammation and pain, maintaining dyspareunia across ages. And Lorraine went ahead again to tell us what is the minimum effective level of estradiol, explaining the 10% change, and she found that 700 picomol per liter is the cutoff for the sexual response and 350 picomol per liter for dyspareunia. Going ahead again, taking all this as informative for us clinicians, what can we learn from all this set of data? That in 10 seconds, we should ask 3 critical questions according to the leading complaint. If the woman is complaining of recurrent cystitis, urge incontinence, or postcoital cystitis, we should immediately ask her, do you have pain at intercourse or you have a vaginal dryness? Indeed, Laumann and co-workers showed through their latent classes analysis of FSD by risk factors that the odd ratio of having dyspareunia, when this is the leading complaint, is 7.61, and of having vaginal dryness and arousal disorder is 4.02. So don't forget to ask in every woman, whatever the leading symptom, vaginal dryness, do you have dyspareunia, do you have LUTS, lower urinary tract symptoms. Does she have this? Ask for this, ask for this. In 10 seconds, we will immediately perceive, diagnose, and then address a comorbidity that is so relevant for their quality of life. Other data tell us exactly and consistently with the Lorraine finding that what women perceive as the main reason for the lack of regular sex in middle age is, yes, their loss of sexual desire, the partner loss of desire, but this is the most important, loss of intimacy with partner. And this loss of intimacy is, I would say, maintained and worsened by his sexual problem, because when he is in difficulty, he avoids intimacy. And this is more hurting to women, more often than just having sex, not being hugged or kissed anymore. And indeed, the changes in sexual arousal are reporting 45% less after the menopause, same, and this is the happy group that has a new partner. So, contributors of couple sexual crisis midlife and beyond are FSD that can be pre-existing to male sexual disorder, ED most, concomitant or reactive to ED or persistent HAPD treatment, but also male sexual dysfunctions or disorder that impact on men and women. So the key message that comes and stems from her research is that addressing the couple sexual concern potentiates the potential, the positive sexual outcomes of both members. Now, quickly and to the end, his perspective. I adore to say that between men and women, from the pathophysiological point of view, besides the obvious anatomic differences, we do have a secret symmetry. And this secret symmetry is perfect in the reading of the etiology of genital arousal disorder, with the overt symptom being in women vaginal dryness and in men the erectile deficit. Both increase almost linearly with age. So, and then I take his perspective, to maximize the benefit of ED treatment, it is critical to address the biological and psychological etiology in both partners. Urologists have learned later on that this is absolutely the case. When they've been, puzzled by seeing that very effective drugs like PDE5 inhibitors have a dropout rate from 30 to 60%. And one of the main reasons of this dropout was her saying, "I don't want you to take this drug anymore." So, indeed, look at the symmetry. When a man has a good erection, this nourishes his self-confidence, emotional trust. This is further nourished by love. And then this goes to support the self-esteem, the cognitive judgment, and positive interaction at social level, with positive feedbacks then from the social role and the contextual appreciation. But when a man has an ED, the first area to be impacted is loss of self-confidence with impairment of the emotional trust and depression. Exactly the same impact we have seen when I presented the endorsement women do for her suffering because of the loss of desire. Love can be an even milder modulator of these crises, and because of this crisis, then the loss of self-esteem will affect the leader attitude in the group, for example, with the impairing effect on the social role, and they become less listening to the contextual appreciation. I said that depression is one of the major consequences of the ED, and indeed, data confirm that. You see here that men with only erectile deficit, more than 50% have depression, much more of those who have just a benign prostate hyperplasia. And again, Laumann looks at the impact of ED on quality of life, focusing on primary partner and happiness. And you see that ED and low desire impact significantly with a high odor ratio on physical satisfaction, emotional satisfaction, and general happiness. So, what is the frequency of female sexual activity before and after partner have an ED? So this data show exactly what Lorraine showed years and years ago, that indeed when he has a problem, she is affected, and you see clearly that after, particularly for couples who had the highest frequency of intercourse, the change is absolutely huge, determined by his problem. This is also true when we look at the sexual frequency, and you see that on your left, when they have sex frequently in the couple, women are very satisfied. They are very satisfied. When sex is very infrequent, women, not only men, are very dissatisfied. And then the effect of ED on female sexual function. You see, before the man had ED, and now. And you see that desire in the woman, arousal in the woman, and orgasm are all affected by his having an erectile problem, while obviously pain remains the same. How satisfied are you with that relationship? So data that mirror what I presented before from the woman's perspective, and you see that whilst before the ED onset, 85% of women were, these were all stable relationship, of course, that accepted to be interviewed with men having the problem, 85% were satisfied before the onset of ED, and only 39% were satisfied currently because of the ED. Interesting, in the study of Fisher, they compared also the PDE5 users with those non-users, and you see that the fact that partners have a restored, say, a better erection because of the drug improves significantly the desire in the female partner, the arousal of the female partner, the orgasm, and this is very interesting, also pain. Because perhaps she's not treated, she has vaginal dryness, and when he has a better erection, she has more pain. So, another reason why we should pay attention to the two of them. So, in conclusion, about 1 in 3 women aged 20 to 70 years in the 4 European countries reported experiencing decreased interest in sex. The percentage of surgical menopause in European women with HSDD range from 7% in Germany to 22% in France. Women with low sexual desire reported significantly less frequent self- and partner-initiated sex, intercourse and orgasm than women with normal levels of sexual desire, except for partner-initiated sex in France. 2, surgically menopausal women with HSDD were significantly more likely to feel dissatisfied with their sex life and relationship than women with normal desire, particularly in Italy and UK. Quite important with a couple perspective and critical for our practice every day, each partner can be the inducer and or the carrier of the sexual problem across the menopause. And last, ED may have a significant negative effect on the sexual experience of the female partner, contributing to HSD. So I think that what we can absolutely agree with, the Lorraine contribution to the field of quality of life across the menopause and beyond, is that it is critical to look at both partners to address the couple sexual crisis across the midlife. Thanks for your attention.
Time for one question. Yeah. Give me, Alexandra, a comment. Last weekend was at an ED conference, so it's been an interesting transition for me. And population data that was presented indicates that the incidence of ED starts to rise significantly from the early 40s. So it's distinct from that activity group, which shows a much later sort of transition. It looks like their transition, the male transition, is actually quite a lot earlier than I'd ever seen data to indicate.
Did they also show the survey in parallel their partner?
No, this was male sexual function.
Because this is a new finding, because all the other were consistent with the later change. So perhaps there is a cultural change here, that is, the perception of the change. Indeed, now we are talking about le dopage du sexe, c'est-à-dire, I'm wrong, in the wrong language, that younger men, now around 40, realize that their erection is not that fantastic as it was before, and they're starting to use PDE5 inhibitors earlier. So whilst in the 90s, men reporting ED were those having a frank, overt problem, now the awareness of the first symptom, of the first signals, is earlier. So perhaps this is a plausible explanation what you are saying, that now the reporting of the change is earlier.
This is what happens to us at these meetings. The problem is, I mean, this is where so much Philippe works come in, because that's an interesting hypothesis, but one could easily say we have an increasing weight, we have a population that's working less, working more and walking less, and we may have a rising rate of atherosclerosis concurrent with a change in our diet and our omega-3, which is affecting things, and we can go on and on with that. And it may simply be what urologists will often say at their meetings, which is, if you want to know about atherosclerosis in the heart, check the penis. And that, in fact, we may be seeing earlier change in atherosclerosis and erectile function, and this may or may not be true, but I'm just saying, who knows? I'm throwing this in as a who knows comment. When you start seeing epidemiological changes in male erectile function, you then have to look at country, diet, what's going on, stress, cytokines. We can go on and on. And then, of course, you get the complication of looking at the other things, which brings us all back to Lorraine's work and Philippe's analysis, which is you can start with this whole list, and until you do the statistical analysis, it's not clear what is doing what and where you have your perfect storm.
I'm not saying, thanks for your comment, Ginny. I'm not saying that this is the only one. As we all know, and Lorraine so beautifully showed that over the years, that the three interact. So I absolutely agree with you that the worsening, the dramatic worsening in the health scores in the population anticipates the onset of diseases, particularly those cardiovascularly determined, but at the same time, awareness of the problem is increasing in the population. Unfortunately, we do not have the same increase in the awareness that we are responsible for the worsening. But this is the third part of the story. Thanks a lot.